It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Kelly McEvers. Coming up, how the riots in L.A. 25 years ago changed the city.
Including how police are trained.
The only language that they taught in the police academy before these changes was in Spanish, hands up, halt or I'll shoot.
That story coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A government spending bill to keep things running through September doesn't include money to build President Trump's promised border wall, but it does include funds to boost technology. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly.
And as promised, the budget will secure our borders and enforce our immigration laws. Border security has three factors. You need people, you need technology, and you need infrastructure. This budget begins to provide all three.
Budget Director Mick Mulvaney says the president is feeling frustrated because Democrats have tried to portray the budget deal as a win for them. President Trump says he'll bring back the border wall funding issue in the fall. The president's nominee for ambassador to China was on Capitol Hill today, reassuring lawmakers that he'd push for fair trade and work with China on North Korea. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more on the confirmation hearing.
Iowa Governor Terry Branstad says if confirmed as U.S. ambassador to China, he'll work to open China's markets to more American goods and stop China from selling underpriced steel in the U.S.
I want to do everything I can to make sure that we stop the unfair and illegal activities that we've seen from China in the steel industry.
Branstad has known China's president ever since Xi Jinping visited Iowa on an agricultural delegation in 1985. And he says he hopes to use that relationship to advance U.S. economic interests and work with China to counter the North Korean nuclear threat, which Branstad says would be his biggest challenge yet. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
More signs consumer spending tightened last month as Ford, Nissan, General Motors, and Toyota all reported sales declines in April. Demand for cars, trucks, as well as SUVs are starting to slow down after seven straight years of growth. You're listening to NPR. The debt-strapped island of Puerto Rico faces a new round of lawsuits from bondholders who say a government plan to cut its $70 billion debt is unconstitutional. The group accuses government officials of strong-arming it into, quote, unfair and illegally punitive terms. It's the first legal challenge to hit the U.S. territory after a freeze on litigation expired this month, leaving Puerto Rico vulnerable to more lawsuits as it tries to dig out of its deepest economic crisis. In Minnesota, students at St. Olaf College have been protesting what some say was an inadequate response to racist graffiti around campus. Now students are calling for action at the small liberal arts college. Leah Donella with NPR's Code Switch team reports.
The weekend was filled with protests and meetings that led to a campus-wide sit-in. Students of color penned a list of demands, including mandatory racial and cultural sensitivity training for faculty members and comprehensive curriculum redesign. On Monday, students presented college president David Anderson with their proposal, and after a lengthy back and forth, he agreed to some initial steps in addressing the students' concerns, including a public meeting with the school board later this week. Anderson called the discussions a great win for you guys and a great win for the college. Leah Donella, NPR News.
Stocks finished higher on Wall Street today. The Dow rose 36 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Maine Office of Tourism, offering travelers an opportunity to explore and discover their very own Maine thing, to be inspired, be original, and be yourself. At MaineQuarterly.com. From Optum, committed to tackling the biggest challenges in healthcare with data-driven solutions designed to improve outcomes and make the system better for everyone. Learn more at Optum.com. Optum, how well gets done. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Kelly McEvers in Culver City, California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. The CEO of United Airlines is apologizing again for the violent removal of a passenger who was dragged off a plane last month.
We had a horrible failure 3 weeks ago. It is not who we are. It is not this company. And then, frankly, it's not this industry.
That mea culpa came at a hearing today held by the House Transportation Committee. Oscar Munoz and other airline executives were grilled about persistent customer service problems. NPR's David Schaefer reports.
Transportation Committee Chairman Bill Schuster wasted no time in setting an almost scolding tone, promising it would not be a pleasant hearing for United CEO Oscar Munoz and the other airline executives sitting before him.
There's something clearly broken when we see passengers being treated the way some of them have been treated in recent flights. Regardless of the contractual relationship between the airline and the ticket holder, it's just common decency and common sense that you don't treat a person that way, let alone a paying customer.
Schuster says after the dragging incident on United and another incident on American Airlines in which a woman with a stroller was removed from a flight, the airline bosses owe the flying public some answers.
This issue is not going away. We're not going away. We will hold you accountable and we expect real results.
Munoz again apologized for the incident in which United passenger David Dow, a 69-year-old doctor from Kentucky, was pulled out of his seat by O'Hare Airport security officers and dragged up the aisle and off the plane after refusing to be involuntarily bumped from the Louisville-bound flight to accommodate United crew members needed to work a flight the next day. Munoz calls the entire episode a mistake of epic proportions.
Unless safety or security are an issue, we will never again ask a customer to give up their seat once they're on board. Simple common sense. Or ask law enforcement to remove a customer from a flight.
Munoz says United will now reduce overbooking of flights, and when it does need to bump passengers, it will now offer up to $10,000 in compensation in hopes of getting more volunteers. Other airlines are changing their policies, too. Southwest, for example, says it will end the practice of overbooking flights altogether. But that's hardly the only problem people have with airlines. Committee members complain about long lines, smaller seats with less room between them, and fees for more legroom, checked bags, and every other little thing at a time profits for the industry are soaring. William McGee of the Consumers Union told the committee that poor customer service is a product of airline consolidation, less competition, and cost-cutting measures like outsourcing.
I'm not sure that many passengers are even aware that when they check in or when they're speaking to a customer service agent, in fact, in many cases, they're wearing a uniform of an airline, and they have a name tag from an airline, but they're outsourced.
Several committee members are calling on the airlines to make changes on their own before Congress forces them to. Again, Republican Transportation Committee Chairman Bill Schuster.
If we don't see meaningful results that improve customer service the next time this committee meets to address the issue, I can assure you, you won't like the outcome.
Such a move would run counter to the Trump administration's promises to reduce industry regulations, but there are already close to half a dozen bills introduced that would prohibit airlines from forcing passengers to give up their seats and add new consumer protections. David Schaefer, NPR News.
It has been 25 years since the L.A. riots, and we've been talking about that quite a bit here on the show. One of the people who's been helping us do that is Karen Grigsby Bates from our Code Switch team. She covered the riots in 1992 and has reported on L.A. for years. Welcome.
Hi, Kelly.
You are here to help me answer a big question, and that is why? Like, why is it important to remember and to talk about this time here in Los Angeles?
Kelly, one of the reasons we're talking about it is because so many people vividly remember that time,
yeah.
April 29th, 1992, whether they lived in L.A. or not. It was a watershed moment, you know, like remembering 9/11 or Martin Luther King's assassination. Now, a lot of that has to do with television coverage, you know, the trial of the four police officers and the beating of Rodney King. His beating was captured on videotape and seen by millions of people around the globe before the jury's verdict. And then the wall-to-wall reporting reporting on the riots themselves. So if you had a TV 25 years ago, it was hard to miss it.
Yeah, a lot of people remember that. And then the question, too, is, you know, now, thinking about what it was like to not only live through the riots, but to keep on living here in L.A. after that moment, how have people here told you they've seen their communities change?
Well, one of the flashpoints during the riots was the relationship between the Black community and Korean shop owners. And a lot of those businesses were in Black communities, but residents felt that many of the Koreans were hostile to them, didn't speak English, and had businesses like liquor stores that were detrimental to the community. Carol Park, who wrote Memoirs of a Cashier, was a 12-year-old kid working the graveyard shift with her mom at her family's gas station in Compton when the violence broke out. When she talked to NPR, she told us Koreans still feel the aftermath.
There are a lot of Korean Americans who have PTSD from that time. Who wouldn't? You lost your entire life. You got shot at. You shot at people. There was no law enforcement. Things are better, but it's still a wound. Of course, they will always carry that.
So it was a big moment for media coverage. It was a big moment for race relations. And it's also such a big moment when we talk about policing, right? I mean, this was the LAPD basically on trial. And still to this day, when I do any stories on policing, it always comes up that that was a moment when the country was able to say, hang on, how are we being policed?
Yeah, because it was one of the first times the country as a whole saw what was going on in Black and brown neighborhoods in L.A. and in cities around the country. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, my God. I spoke with lawyer Connie Rice, who worked with the police on reform for several years. And she mentioned this about how the LAPD itself has changed. She said, although the city had a significant Latino population 25 years ago,
the only language that they taught in the police academy before these changes was in Spanish, and the only thing they taught them was hands up, halt, or I'll shoot.
So in 1992, the sworn force was about 21% Latino. Today, it's almost 45%. Back in 92, the force was almost 60% white. Now it's like 30% white.
And just one last question, Karen. Could this happen again?
Interesting you should ask that. You know, a lot of people say no, but a Loyola Marymount poll published in the LA Times last week said a number of respondents across the city, especially young ones, say yes. So it just depends on where you sit or live. Like Jasmine Kanick, who's a police critic and a commentator. She grew up in South LA and she still lives here, and she feels very strongly we need to remember these things. We met with her in a windy parking lot at a shopping mall in South LA.
When you don't talk about it, it dies. And a lot of people went through a lot in 1992, and I think their stories are important. I think we're doomed to repeat a lot of things that we don't share from generation to generation. I think everyone was affected by what happened in 1992. It didn't matter if you lived in the valley or at the beach. You couldn't go to work. You couldn't go to school. You were scared to go into certain neighborhoods. Maybe your neighborhood was on fire. Some people that I know, they actually became activists after 1992 and still are activists to this day.
Like Marquise Harris-Dawson, who was elected to the LA City Council.
Karen Grigsby-Bates from our Code Switch team, thank you for bringing us these voices and your perspective. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The disputed region of Kashmir, claimed by both India and Pakistan, has gone dark on social media. The Indian government last week ordered internet service providers to cut off access to Facebook, Twitter, and 20 other platforms. Social media is where protesters in Kashmir used to post information the government doesn't like. With us now to talk about this is NPR's Julie McCarthy in New Delhi. Hi there.
Hi.
Have you been able to reach activists in Kashmir in the past week?
Well, yes, I have, Kelly. Kashmir has not been cut off from the world. I could reach people on the telephone and by email.
Okay.
But they said that the amplifying effect of social media has evaporated, right? They can't connect with a lot of people in ways that they'd like and in the ways that they're used to. And there's a widespread feeling that the government really doesn't want people to be communicating with each other.
If that's true, why did the government only cut social media? I mean, why not also cut the phone lines?
Well, that's a good question. I think largely, you know, young Kashmiris, who are driving the dissent today in Kashmir, they don't like talking on the phone. So that form of communication is already really not so much of an issue. Phones can be tapped. They feel like they're under surveillance. They don't want the authorities to know what they're doing. So they much prefer these messaging sites like WhatsApp, which is one of the 22 platforms that was banned. You know, I couldn't reach people in Kashmir this past week on WhatsApp. So yes, these sites are being blocked. But, you know, it's an internet blackout, and that's an important distinction. The government is blocking it because it feels that the web is creating a whole new set of issues on the ground, especially as they relate to these rising anti-India protests.
So, yeah, give us a sense of that. Like, how critical is social media to organizing these protests or any other anti-government activity?
Well, I think increasingly it is. You know, first of all, Kashmir has been an open revolt for the better part of 9 months. And this is something that the security forces are really struggling with. And they're changing. These demonstrations are changing. You've got young women now on the front lines. You've got protesters running toward military operations rather than away from them. And something else is going on, Kelly, that goes to the heart of the problem as far as the government is concerned. You've got young men with a stone in one hand and in the other a mobile phone taking videos. And they are capturing very graphic images. And these video warriors are posting this stuff. They're leapfrogging over mainstream media. They're putting it on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, and they're shaping public debate over Kashmir. And that's what the government hopes to shut down, because they say it's feeding the anger in the valley.
Have the activists figured out ways to work around the internet blackout?
Well, I think that's a work in progress, but there are workarounds. For example, there are these VPNs, these virtual private networks, VPN providers. They encrypt communications, which is why people worried about privacy use them. I'm told they're not popular yet in Kashmir Valley. But remember, Kelly, you know, this is a generation out on the streets born in the 1990s. They tend to be quite tech savvy, and they're looking for ways to sidestep this ban. You know, the protests still do erupt, but with less publicity. You know, that said, the demonstrations in Kashmir tend to be spontaneous. They're really not driven by the internet. You know, they happen with or without it.
Is there any sign that this blackout will end soon?
Well, you know, the internet service providers don't seem to be raising any objections. The government said it's going to last 1 month. The army is very concerned about a hot summer in Kashmir. Hot meaning politically hot. And it would like to cool things down now. And I think this blackout is more likely to be prolonged than it would be ended early.
It's NPR's Julie McCarthy in New Delhi. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Boston Red Sox issued an apology this morning after reports of racial taunting at their game last night. Adam Jones, an outfielder with the visiting Baltimore Orioles, said he was subjected to racial epithets and that at least one fan threw a bag of peanuts at him. Shira Springer of member station WBUR reports that the fallout isn't over.
It was an unusually raucous night at Fenway Park. After the game, Jones called the heckling one of the worst experiences of his 12-year Major League career.
It just shows that people still live in their own world. They still have their own views, obviously. And some people like to express hatred towards another person.
The fan who threw a bag of peanuts at Jones was identified and escorted out of the ballpark. That fan was one of 34 people ejected last night, some for alcohol-related incidents, some for fighting, and one for using profane language directed at a player, presumably Jones. Red Sox team president Sam Kennedy says reports on last night's ejections didn't specifically reference racial taunting. But, he says, that is not the point.
We take Adam Jones at his word, and that is unacceptable for what happened, and we're going to take steps to address it.
But those steps remain uncertain. Jones is not the first black professional athlete to experience racism in Boston. Even professional athletes who have called Boston home have dealt with racism during their careers. And despite efforts to change that reputation, it persists. Here's Governor Charlie Baker.
Oh, I don't think it reflects Massachusetts. I mean, I've lived here my whole life, and I take tremendous pride in the fact that Massachusetts is a state that and a community that welcomes diversity.
But Boston NAACP President Tanisha Sullivan says what Jones experienced was a reflection of the worst of the city of Boston.
It illuminates the subculture that exists here in and around the city of Boston, where someone would believe that they could go to Fenway Park in a crowded stadium and use this racially charged language and not be held accountable.
Adam Jones and the Orioles will be back playing the Red Sox at Fenway Park tonight. For NPR, I'm Shira Springer in Boston.
Now we're going to talk about minor league baseball. Right now, thousands of players across the country are doing what they can to make the majors, and many of them are struggling. Minor league baseball has never been a big moneymaker. Most players at this level don't even earn minimum wage. A lawsuit is trying to change that, while young ball players try to hang on. NPR's Tom Goldman has the story.
Now the 1-2 pitch, and Nash swings and misses. Chased a fastball that was up and outside. That is the ninth strikeout for Tyler DeLoach.
In five minor league seasons, pitcher Tyler DeLoach racked up 457 strikeouts. The 6'6" left-hander was good enough to get to AAA, one level away from the promised land, the majors. But last year, at age 25, he quit the game. DeLoach from North Carolina remembers the moment he made that very tough decision.
Yeah, exactly. When I got my W-2.
His wage and salary form said he made between $14,000 and $15,000 for a season of playing pro ball.
Even though this is a dream of mine, you know, this is the real world. You got to pay bills, and this isn't getting it done.
The dream of making it to the big leagues had fortified DeLoach, but then a jolt in 2015. His dad, who'd been a financial safety net, got sick and died. It forced DeLoach to take stock. Last season in AAA, he made $2,200 a month before taxes. Just one step up the ladder in the majors, the lowest paid players made $42,000 a month. After paying rent, student loans, car payment, clubhouse dues, food, gas, cell phone, DeLoach hoped to break even. And like all minor leaguers, he got paid only during the season from April to September. No pay for spring training.
It starts to take away from the focus that you need at the game because you're trying to figure out, well, what do I need to do this offseason? Do I need to get a job? Like, how am I going to afford to do this?
But here's the thing about Tyler DeLoach. He was better off than most minor leaguers.
The average minor league baseball player is getting around $7,500 or less.
Attorney Garrett Brushhouse says that figure includes all levels of minor league baseball, and it's about half of what a full-time minimum wage worker in the U.S. makes. Brushhouse is leading the fight for better pay. He's a former minor league pitcher who threw some high heat at Major League Baseball in 2014. That's when he sued MLB and its 30 teams. MLB pays minor league salaries, and Brushhouse wants minor leaguers bumped up at least to full-time minimum wage pay.
This is a $10 billion industry that has seen just revenue grow exponentially in recent years. And so they can certainly afford to pay these guys $15,000 per year.
If each team paid that amount to its roughly 250 minor leaguers, it would cost about $3.75 million. That's a year's salary for one major league player, not quite making the average of $4.4 million. Major League Baseball can afford it, but doesn't think it should have to. MLB responded to an interview request by emailing a statement. It says federal guarantees of minimum wage and overtime pay don't apply to minor league players. The majority of those players, says MLB, are short-term seasonal apprentices. But minor leaguers typically sign a standard 7-year contract, and they work 50 to 60 hours a week at spring training and work during the off-season on baseball skills and fitness, all for no pay.
They're treating it as a professional business and calling it an internship or an apprenticeship, and I think that this is more of a profession than it is an internship.
This minor league player asked not to be identified because he's afraid it might jeopardize his job, a job he says is full-time. He's in his early 20s, plays single-A ball in the Midwest, and he says he started feeling the money pinch this season. He supports the lawsuit, but beyond that, he's trying to engage fellow players in a conversation about changing the financial situation.
You know, all the players see it as far as it needs to happen. It's just a lot of people are so caught up, hey, I need to, you know, do this to play. I don't want to look bad doing it. You know, I want to do the right things by the organization. And, you know, I think you can do the right thing by the organization, but also, you know, think about future players as well and be able to change things for the better.
There's no minor league players union. Garrett Brushhouse would love to see one in the future. For now, he's focused on the lawsuit, which includes several thousand minor leaguers. Recently, the suit gained limited class status. Brushhouse says a trial date could be set within the next few weeks. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Hulu, presenting The Handmaid's Tale, adapted from the novel by Margaret Atwood, a story of survival in a near-future society where a cruel regime rules in what was formerly the United States, starring Elizabeth Moss and now streaming on Hulu. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value, and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life, at gatesfoundation.org. And from Atlassian, maker of collaboration software Jira, Confluence, Bitbucket, and Trello, working to help teams across industries ascend to new heights to create what's next. Learn more at atlassian.com. Atlassian. Team up.
Broadcasting from the campus of Morehead State University, Morehead State Public Radio includes 90.3 FM WMKY Morehead and Translator W202BH Inez. It is currently 69 degrees here on the campus of Morehead State University. Your weather for tonight, mostly clear, low of around 44. And then for Wednesday, sunshine early, then becoming cloudy later in the day, slight chance of a rain shower. And for Wednesday night, increasing clouds with showers arriving sometime after midnight, thunder possible, low of around 53 degrees, chance of rain is at 40%. And then for Thursday, cloudiness, occasional rain showers in the afternoon, thunder possible, high of around 68 degrees, chance of rain is at 70%. And for Thursday night, rain and early, then remaining mainly cloudy, low of around 51 degrees. Chance of rain is at 100%, rainfall around half an inch. And for Friday, considerable cloudiness with occasional rain showers, high of around 56 degrees. Chance of rain is at 40%. Stay tuned. Coming up next here on Morehead State Public Radio, we have more of All Things Considered.